You're listening to TIP.
On today's show, we're talking about a very intriguing topic, Bitcoin. Now, we've covered this topic many times on the show. In fact, the first time we covered Bitcoin here on the Investors Podcast, the price was in the $200 range. Today, it's about $8,000. Although this fascinating topic has some of the most volatile price movements in any financial market, it doesn't seem to die or go away. So what in the world is going on with Bitcoin and what is it? On today's show, we talked to one of the most reputable and well-known Bitcoin influencers, Mr. Tur de Meester. When we talk to Tur, we're not covering advanced crypto topics. Instead, we're going to talk about the reason the Bitcoin community believes in this movement so strongly and how some of the technology works and what it's trying to achieve. In short, this is our coverage of Bitcoin 101. So if you've ever tried to understand the why behind this movement, Tur is one of the best people you could ever listen to. So without further delay, here's our coverage of Bitcoin Basics.
You are listening to The Investors Podcast, where we study the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Preston Pish, and as always, I'm accompanied by my co-host, Stig Broderson. And I'll tell you, we are really pumped to have Tur back on the show. Tur, welcome back to the Investors Podcast. Always awesome to have you here.
Hi, Preston. Hi, Stig. Good to be back.
There has been a lot that has happened since the last time we talked. The last time we talked, I believe, was in 2017 during the meteoric rise of Bitcoin and many other crypto coins. And after we saw it peak, at least Bitcoin peak in December of 2017, we've had about an 80% decline in the price of Bitcoin. I think it got down into like the mid 3000 range or something like that. But since that bottoming, which probably happened a few months ago, Bitcoin has had a little bit of a surge here, and I think it just hit over $6,000. And so my question to you, Tur, is, and I think everybody who's listening to this is wondering this question, why is Bitcoin still relevant today?
Yeah, and why does it remain relevant throughout these rallies and crashes? We've seen several of them. The first one in 2010, the second one 2011, there were two in 2013. We had a major rally and crash in 2014. And then the one that most people are aware of now is the 2017 cycle. Rather than ask, like, well, why is Bitcoin relevant? I would kind of turn it upside down and wonder, like, well, do these crashes take away from the value of Bitcoin? And why are they happening? Bitcoin is relevant because it has the promise of being a digital store of value, you know, not only for millennials, but definitely very appealing to millennials. And it's something that for a long time, like ever since cryptography became something that private individuals could work with and academics started developing onto that, and then in combination with the rise of the internet, this idea of a digital cash or digital gold really was out there as a challenge for scientists. Like going back to the 80s, there were ideas and plans to try and make this work. And so Bitcoin was the first time that all the pieces came together in a very elegant way to make it a reality. And so now we do have, and I'm kind of excited that I found this word. Bitcoin is now a denarian currency. It's over 10 years old, which is quite amazing if you think of it. Like we've had almost zero downtime during that time. It's never been stopped. There has never been reorganization of the ledger to censor transactions or to roll back transactions for nothing. Like there's been exchanges that were hacked and that tried to get old transactions to be reverted, and that this just never happened. So it's as good as gold in that sense, is that transactions are real and irreversible, but then it has all these additional benefits of the digital world where you can, I mean, we'll talk about it more, I'm sure. But so the gist of it is that Bitcoin is relevant because it's a politically neutral store of value. That's the promise of it. It could become a reserve asset. And so much of the world's prosperity is built on this ledger that gold was. Like the gold was a scarce measuring stick for value. It allowed you to store value and then later deploy it in however you saw fit as an entrepreneur or as an investor. And so Bitcoin kind of restores that idea. We kind of lost our way with fiat currencies that can be debased, that are very, you know, very effective because you can send them around the world easily, but they can just continually be debased. And so they're losing that feature of store of value. And so that to me is what's so attractive about Bitcoin.
For somebody who's hearing your response to why it's still relevant today, They might get lost in some of the technology talk, or they might get lost in some of the other aspects of how we can just talk about all this technical stuff. Immediately, anytime you talk to somebody with Bitcoin, it gets to be a very technical conversation. But what I think is really interesting is when you take a step back and you say, what is it fundamentally that Bitcoin is solving? Like, why would a person own Bitcoin opposed to owning gold? Or what is it that Bitcoin brings to the world that we don't already have with the currencies that exist?
If you look into the white paper that was published in 2008 to basically explain what Bitcoin was about, in the introduction, Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonymous creator, he says, and I quote, "Commerce on the internet has come to rely almost exclusively on financial institutions serving as trusted third parties to process electronic payments." So then he goes on to explain how, you know, the fact that we have to trust a third party, it comes at significant cost and significant risk to savers, to people that want to transact digitally. Like, I mean, he says online, but it's really like globally, like all the money is digital. So we're talking about it, this huge market. And one of the main problems that has emerged for people that want to save or store value, it's really hard to know how scarce the money is these days. And there's this aphorism, I forget who wrote it, but it's like money is scarce. And if it's no longer scarce, it's no longer money. So there is definitely that breaking point that we've seen at some point, things break down and get pretty bad. And so how do you create a system that is provably scarce, where I have a digital token, but I can't just copy it and, you know, send one to Stig and another to Preston, even though originally I only had one? How do you kind of prevent forgery? Bitcoin is just this really elegant solution to that problem. And the basic idea is that rather than you having to trust, like, hey, this is a real coin, believe me, I'm some kind of fancy bank and you just have to trust me, I will only ever create this much inflation, like, trust me, rather than having to do that, I can just look at the actual protocol and see the rules that are embedded in that. And then I can see how many computers in the world are choosing to run this protocol. And then when it comes to one Bitcoin, am I like spending the same Bitcoin twice? How do I know what the valid transaction is? Because, you know, presumably only the first time you spend it, that should be the valid time. The second time you've already spent it, so it's no longer in your wallet. And the way you can verify that is by looking at the ledger that has the most accumulated work embedded into it. It's something that seems wasteful on the surface, actually serves a very deep purpose that has to do with security and not having to actually trust an authority.
Sure, it's interesting you would say that. And for a person that hears this and might not have a background in computer science or understand programming, you say that you can look at the protocol to verify the system and build the trust in the system. But most people, including myself, would have no idea how to do that. And we're probably not looking to spend the time learning how to do that. How should we think about all of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm not a computer programmer either, so I definitely had to ask myself that question. How do I trust a trustless system that I cannot verify myself? The way Bitcoin does that, or kind of helps people trust it, is that the entire code base is open source, so anybody can look at it, and there's the explicit invitation to do so. So that means that for the past 10 years, hackers around the world and computer scientists and operational security experts have been explicitly invited to audit this. There are instances of investors who've hired teams of hackers to try and break the system and to try and kind of find a loophole. And of course, there's also financial incentive to do so. Like, as the value of the ledger increases, the financial incentive increases to find the bug that allows you to drain the account, so to speak. And so that strengthens my trust over time. And it's like that with a lot of things in life where, you know, how do you trust the internet works? Well, you know, you use it every day, but there's also, you rely on certain proxies. How do you know that this gold coin is real? You can pay someone who's an expert that can really verify it. The fact that it's out there and it's open source, it's kind of it's an invitation to the world, like, hey, I'm the champion, like, you know, beat me up if you can. Right now, you could call it $100 billion bug bounty on Bitcoin. Like, hey, if you can crack this, here's the bounty, right? It's right here. Just get it. You know, obviously, you cannot crack all the accounts in Bitcoin, but even just one, there is accounts out there that have easily over 100,000 Bitcoin. So that's way, way over $100 million just sitting in one Bitcoin account. I think it's testament to the Bitcoin protocol and the continual conservative improvements that it's very, very reliable and trustworthy.
Trace Mayer has just a great discussion on network effects. One of the reasons I like this so much is because whenever I talk to people about Bitcoin, one of the first things that they say is, well, if these people created the code for this, whoever they are, how do I know that they just can't go back and change the code to adjust it? Because right now, the selling point on Bitcoin is that there will only be 21 million coins, no more, no less. It's going to get to 21 million coins. And so you have a fixed monetary baseline, therefore it can't be debased. But how do I know that somebody can't go in there and adjust the code?
Oh, you can absolutely do that. I mean, Charlie Lee has done it in 2011 when he created Litecoin. He just took the code base and was like, hey, let's tweak this little rule. And now we have a coin with 84 million coin supply rather than Bitcoin's 21 million. So you can totally do that. The challenge is that if you change the basic rules of Bitcoin in your new code base and you start running that software, it's not going to talk to the other nodes. The other nodes are going to reject it because it doesn't adhere to the same rules that they do. There's kind of like a Babylonian problem that occurs, but there's no limit. You know, over 1,000 altcoins out there and they're all iterations, but they don't ever, like the Bitcoin network never listens to those nodes. And so the only changes that over time have been accepted by Bitcoin nodes are changes that restrict rather than expand the rules. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's a little bit like state legislation, at least in theory. It can make more specifications as to what people can do, but it shouldn't violate the constitutional rights that are maybe, you know, across the federation. So you could call the Bitcoin core protocol as a sort of constitution. And so you can either propose a hard fork to change the constitution, which for the past 10 years has always been rejected by Bitcoin savers because they don't want to see the value of their coins being diluted. That's a hard fork. That's always been rejected. But what has been sometimes accepted is more specific rules, and those are called soft forks, where you kind of narrow things down a bit and smoothen the edges and make things more efficient, as long as it doesn't violate the core ideas of what Bitcoin is about. So for example, the 21 million supply, the 10-minute block time, the very, very basic things, they are really hard-coded into Bitcoin. And it's true, like technically anyone can change the rules, but it's kind of like saying, well, you speak English and Stig speaks English, but what if I change English and I make it into a new language? Like, wouldn't that mess up your day? Or like, no, because I would be on my own on an island with my newfangled language and you guys would just choose to keep talking English. So it's kind of like disqualifying yourself. If you change the rules, the conversation is over.
That's a great and very relatable example. So what if the community wants to change something in the open source code, which has happened multiple times before? What is the process of proposing and then implementing changes?
There's a mature process that has developed over time, and it was very much inspired on how open source code bases are adjusted and upgraded, even though nobody's really in charge of open source projects like Linux and things like that. And responsibilities are named in that ecosystem, but it's still not controlled. It just means like somebody helps facilitate the process and they're the ones, and usually GitHub is used. And if you have a proposal to make a change in Bitcoin, it's called a Bitcoin improvement proposal, and that's subject to peer review for a while, and then finally propose it to several core developers who have a very long experience, and then it'll go through significant review to make sure that, you know, we're not, like I said, we're not changing the constitution, we're just trying to make things a bit more efficient, for example. And so eventually it gets merged into a new release of Bitcoin, and then that release is basically just proposed to the world. Some developers are like, hey, you know, here's a version of Bitcoin that we think is a little better, feel free to give it a run. And it's a very gradual adoption process. Like, you're not really encouraged to assume that change on day one, but because it has efficiency improvements, there is this economic incentive, especially for miners and professionals, to run the latest version, the most efficient version of the software. But of course, I mean, they don't want to expose their customers to vulnerabilities, so they might do internal testing as well to make sure. So yeah, one example was the soft fork of that merged SegWit into Bitcoin, and that allowed the block size to grow from around 1 megabyte to theoretically could be up to 4. So Bitcoin's capacity increased, the transaction size shrunk, which means that the average fee that you have to pay to the network is also going to be lower. And so that's valuable for exchanges and miners. It was like a 2-3 year process where finally over 50% of the transactions are now SegWit transactions. So it's a very slow process. And I think that's good.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Bade, and most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host two live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and you feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what's happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what's happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools that I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I read each morning to kick off my day to stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
I don't really mean to get into a lot of the technical stuff, but I think it's important for people to hear some of this, especially if they haven't paid attention to Bitcoin since 2017, because that's one of the interesting changes that have occurred since back then is this SegWit update. And what it's allowed is what's called Lightning Network. In the most simplistic way you can describe this, what is the Lightning Network and why is it important?
The simplest description would basically be that you go out with your friends and you go to a bar, and rather for the barman to register every single one of your transactions with a credit card, he just keeps open a tab and just closes it at the end of the night. Another word for it is payment channel. So you basically, for small amounts of transactions, you defer it to another layer. It's a smart contract layer, basically, that keeps track of all these tabs and then occasionally settles with the Bitcoin main chain. Because Bitcoin main chain transactions only have a capacity of about 3 to 5 transactions per second. So, and they are expensive, right? They can cost 50 cents, half a dollar, or sometimes several dollars. And Lightning solves that and allows for very fast, huge volumes of transactions, but still denominated in Bitcoin.
So let's say I completely understand and trust Bitcoin. I understand that you're being incentivized to hack the system. As you said, it's been running for more than a decade and it hasn't happened yet. Having said that though, why would I trust the new system? Why would I trust the bartender?
It's not entirely trustless in that sense. So it's just a metaphor to kind of show that we're deferring. It's somewhat less robust than the Bitcoin main chain, but it's still very much lower trust. Like it's still what you could call a decentralized layer. If you have a balance on the Lightning Network, you cannot be stolen from very easily. I mean, Bitcoin is the most secure database on the planet. Like that is a very high bar. You lower that bar a little bit to allow for very fast transaction settlements. At the core, it's still a trustless solution.
So you would describe the security risk on Lightning to be way less than the security risk on an exchange like Coinbase. You think that that holds a lot more security risk.
I don't feel confident to say that, because if you have, that's the problem with trusted third parties, is that sometimes they are trustworthy and sometimes they do a great job, and having to secure your own Lightning node, that's on you, right? That's for you to take these precautions. And also the software is still in very early stages. So it's kind of like, I'm more talking about the promise of the protocol rather than the way it is today. In the long run, rather than saying what's more secure, I would say it's more permissionless. You know, imagine someone in India, they want to buy in-game credits on their phone. They can use a Lightning wallet. They don't need to have any bank give them permission first.
So let's say that I'm worried about the debasement of my currency. I might live in, say, Turkey, and I'm considering whether or not I should hold gold or I should hold Bitcoin, perhaps both of them, because they have the same argument about a predictable and fixed monetary baseline. How do you think through what I should own in my portfolio in that case?
Demographic surveys and all the data points in the direction that Bitcoin is being adopted slowly. And it's right now only at maybe 5% adoption globally. That's probably even overstating it, depending on how you look at it. It's going through this adoption curve, which means that the value is going to increase by a lot, if I'm right about that. And then on top of that, we have this demographic tailwind in the sense that millennials just absolutely love Bitcoin. Like the early adopters were mostly millennials. And right now, if you look at the appetite from investors, it's mostly millennials. And right now, millennials are, I think in their maybe late 20s, early 30s, kind of on average. In about 10 years, in 2029, their collective purchasing power is going to supersede that of Generation X and also the baby boomers. So that's going to be the largest earning generation. My hypothesis is that the gold that they inherit, part of that is going to be sold and Bitcoin is going to be bought by millennials. And of course, you know, you don't have to inherit the gold. You can also think about how to protect your portfolio against systemic risk. And, you know, that's when gold and other liquid assets with low third party risk come into play. So that would be my case for why you want to own some Bitcoin, is that it's going to complement gold. And I mean, maybe we'll talk about this more, but Bitcoin has a lot more functionality, technical functionality than gold. It really can become the internet of money because it's natively digital. And that makes a big difference versus gold. If you want to make gold part of the digital world, you have to then build a gold bank. And then all of a sudden you're talking about trusted third parties again.
This might sound kind of funny for a person who has as much experience as you have in this field, but whenever I've had conversations with people that know nothing about Bitcoin, I hear them often say, oh, well, it's $6,000 a coin. I'm not going to buy one of those. Slam this one out of the ballpark for us. Let people know that it's divisible and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so saying one Bitcoin is too expensive because it's $6,000 today, that's kind of the equivalent of saying, you know, one 400 ounce ingot of gold is too expensive because it's over $500,000 today. Like that is kind of going past the fact that we're talking about a fungible good. It's almost infinitely divisible. So you can just as much, you know, buy 0.01 Bitcoin. It doesn't matter. You're still claiming a bit of real estate on Bitcoin Island, right? Bitcoin Island is 21 million coins, whatever that surface is, you claim your stake, and it doesn't really matter how small that is. It doesn't have to be a one coin stake.
So I can go out and buy 0.007 Bitcoins if I want.
Yeah, I mean, for the moment, Bitcoin is divisible up until 100 millionth of a Bitcoin. That unit is called a Satoshi. So yeah, you can theoretically, probably even in practice, you can buy 100 millionth of a Bitcoin. And with the Lightning Network, you actually can. There was a competition recently. Somebody sold an art piece, and the piece would be given to the person that managed to pay the least amount of Bitcoin. And so in Lightning, you can actually go below one Satoshi. So I forget the amount, but somebody calculated that the value of the winning bid was lower than the price of one grain of sand.
I don't even know how that'd be possible if the protocol set up for, 10^-8 units you can go down to. So how in the world can you do that on Lightning that you go below it?
Well, it's kind of like it's the same thing with the tabs, right? I mean, you can, even though you have a 1 cent coin in your wallet and that's supposedly the lowest denominator, the bartender can agree to keep a tab for a lower amount.
Yeah. That makes sense. Oh, that's cool.
Another question that is often asked to Preston and me, and I'm sure you hear that a lot too, Tur, is that why Bitcoin There's so many other coins out there. How do we know that Bitcoin is the coin that will prevail and maintain the position as the top currency in terms of market cap?
I mean, I would be hypocritical if I said, oh, just trust me, it's Bitcoin. Like, obviously, don't trust me and you know, do your own research. I guess my suggestion would be look at the developers involved in Bitcoin, like their pedigree is just of a totally different level compared to any of the other altcoins. These are people that have actually built the internet. These are the people that are now building on Bitcoin. And then I would also say, consider this perspective on Bitcoin is that what Bitcoin is about, it's not, you know, we can talk a lot about, you know, the technicalities and things like that. But at its core, what Bitcoin does is it converts electricity into financial reliability. All this work that goes into Bitcoin, all this mining, what that is just building a moat around Bitcoin to make it immutable, to have this decentralized consensus. And so once we've come up with a mechanism to do that reliably, why would we need 10 different protocols to do that? I mean, and Bitcoin has shown, it's been around for over 10 years now. It has the Lindy effect, I believe, which is this, Nassim Taleb talks about that often. It's a phenomena that as time progresses, they become only stronger, lodged into the human consciousness and in society. And so the fact that it's around for 10 years already, it predicts that it'll be around for a lot longer. You know, in terms of brand value, you have to consider that too. In my mind, it's really the .com of the space compared to .org, .net, .ru. Like, there is no physical reason why .com domain names are 80% of the entire domain name market and why the value of, for example, pizza.com or investing.com is going to be literally 100x that of the next domain name at times, or at least 10 times higher. And the reason that it does have a higher value is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's just that if you buy a .com domain name, it signals to the world that you are making a long-term investment, you believe in your business, that you're not just going to go for a quick scam. And so I believe it's similar in Bitcoin, whereas the actual protocol may be only a little bit different from the next altcoin. The fact that Bitcoin has kept its integrity for 10 years, has not changed its rules, has the largest by far, I would have to look up the percentages, but probably around 90% of the electricity in the world that's used for mining coins is going to Bitcoin. It's definitely above 70%. And so it has that huge firewall around it. The fact that it's slow to change is actually its core virtue, is the fact that you can rely on it. So it's almost like an element on the periodic table where you can just, it has these features that are just never going to change. And that's what will allow the world to build on it. Those would be some suggestions of areas for people to look in. And then finally, maybe also consider if people talk about features and say, oh, well, this coin has that feature that Bitcoin doesn't. Consider that digital protocols are developed in layers. So you start with a core basic bottom layer that has one feature, and then new layers are added on top of that in a stack. So people talk, for example, about the internet protocol stack, like TCP/IP is only a part of that. And so the same with Bitcoin, if the core protocol is reliable, then you can reliably build new layers on top of it. And that's what's happening with the Lightning Network, with these federated sidechains and other things that are happening. All those features that people are saying, oh, but my altcoin has that, that's all going to come to Bitcoin. It just needs some time. And that's something that the market is learning, is that it's an incredibly rich ecosystem. And we don't need to invent a new Bitcoin to have, you know, the next fancy feature, because it can be embedded in higher layers.
So Bitcoin's a protocol. And for people that are not computer science majors, when you say TCICP, and you're talking about the protocol layer that the internet runs on, and Bitcoin is a protocol, help a person understand what a protocol is.
Yeah, a protocol basically is just a way of doing things. You know, the fact that all around the world, we use similar shipping containers, you could call that a protocol. It's just a universally accepted standard way of doing things. And that's what sets apart a unique design, such as, you know, this architect is building my home uniquely for me. That's what sets that apart from a protocol, which is going to be universally. It's almost like a language is a protocol too, right? The fact that we're talking English, even though we're probably sitting on different continents right now, it allows us to move information around. The same with these shipping containers. It's one piece, one element of the entire supply chain of the world, but it's important. The fact that it is so uniform and reliable. So that's the interesting thing about protocols, is that sometimes their inertia and their immutability, and you know, that is sometimes really the strength of it. Like, you know, the fact that very simple things like bolts are uniform around the world, or just so many examples of that. So that to me is the intuitive way to think about protocols.
So let's shift gears here. Sure, back in 2017, when you had the huge surge in the price of Bitcoin, the vast majority of investment banks and other big financial players did not allow people to purchase Bitcoin through their platforms. A lot has happened since then. What is the most important development over the past 2 years for the Bitcoin community?
We're making incredible inroads in that sense. I call it Bitcoin's financialization, where more and more wrappers are built around it, more financial institutions are integrating it into their operations. Yeah, so 2017 was a very modest start. We had LedgerX with their physically settled Bitcoin futures, CME, also a Bitcoin futures product. So that was a big announcement. And then it took until 2018 until ICE, the company that owns the New York Stock Exchange, they announced a data product that was related to cryptocurrencies, and then also a Bitcoin futures platform that's called Bakkt. So that's going to go live later this year. 2018 was also the year where Goldman Sachs invested in cryptocurrency custodians. We also had TD Ameritrade backing a Bitcoin futures platform. This year really is quite stunning. I mean, we have Fidelity of all players, like $7 trillion in assets under management. They have already soft launched digital custody. So they are becoming a Bitcoin custodian. The NASDAQ is launching Bitcoin futures. Northern Trust is going to provide cryptocurrency custody probably also this year. So, I mean, these are the on-ramps that large institutions need. They also need Bitcoin insurance, so that's also coming. Traders, they need more sophisticated products, which is exactly what's being provided. This is huge. This is really, really huge. And it's happening in the bear market. The fact that these on-ramps are going live despite the price being down 70% really shows that there's long-term commitment from these very large institutions.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
So for a person that's looking at this with maybe a skeptical point of view, they're saying, oh, you know, this sounds great, but I can't go to the store. I can't go to the mall. I can't go to the gas station and buy something with Bitcoin. So how is that potentially changing in the future? When am I going to be able to pull out a card and swipe it and pay with Bitcoin?
I think, unfortunately, in the early years of Bitcoin, it was very often promoted as e-commerce. Like, this is the new e-commerce currency. And a lot of Silicon Valley startups, they started excitingly building payment systems on Bitcoin. And it was just too early. It's only the Lightning Network that allows for these fast payments. Before that, we basically had a very clunky system that's way worse than PayPal, like much slower, maybe more reliable, but definitely not as performant as PayPal or let alone Swift or something. So I think it was kind of putting the cart before the horse, trying to expect of Bitcoin to be a payment network. But what we have seen is this massive growth in reliability and usability of the core features of Bitcoin, which is, you know, the digital gold idea, reliable custody, so many better hardware wallets out there now. So you can really be your own bank. For Bitcoin to become attractive as a payment currency, it has to grow more on the ladder of growing into becoming a money. People often say, well, you know, money has four features. I think it's actually more accurate to say that money evolves in four stages rather than, you know, it's either zero or one. It's actually a process. And so money always starts out as this collectible that doesn't have anything else going for it. It's just something interesting that people want to own. The next phase of money is store of value, like people want to own it because other people consider it. And then the next stage is, to some extent, it is used as a settlement mechanism, as a payment. And then the final stage is unit of account. It's just basically people, it's so embedded, it's so universal that people think in it. Like, it's like language, right? It's like, that's the final stage of language, is if you speak it. And so to me, people paying in Bitcoin and thinking in Bitcoin, that's really, whatever you imagine the potential future of Bitcoin, that would be the final stage. That's what Jack Dorsey is talking about, of like, this is the currency of the internet. Like, that is going to be that last stage. So I would say, you know, don't get distracted by critics who lambast it for not a lot of stores are accepting it or something. I would say, like, look at how many family offices own it. Like, Fidelity did a survey recently, 22% of their family offices own it and funds. Out of the 400 that they surveyed, 50% of them said that they plan to own it. So these are the numbers that matter, in my opinion. Like, is it used and seen as a store of value around the world?
You had billionaires like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and Jack Dorsey of Twitter and Square who are really into cryptocurrencies. And specifically for the two of them, talk to us about the idea of decentralized applications that has crypto coin tethered into the protocol layer.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you mentioned Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg, because to me, they represent kind of opposite sides of a spectrum. And you're right. I mean, they both want to be involved in what we call the cryptocurrency space. So Jack Dorsey, he's very explicit about being a Bitcoin believer and wanting to help Bitcoin become a standard and integrate Bitcoin with, I mean, obviously, eventually Twitter, but for now, it's Cash App. That's about 7 million users. It's actually one of the best places to buy Bitcoin. I think they have a $10,000 limit, weekly limit or something like that. That's on the one hand. And then on the other hand, there's Mark Zuckerberg, who has hired this team, a lot of which comes apparently from PayPal, to create what I believe basically a digital token backed by dollars. So what's called a stable coin. And then the idea is that, a little bit like China, really, where people bank and transact often through their social media accounts, I think the idea is that people are going to use Facebook for financial transactions between friends and maybe even have your employer pay you using Facebook and things like that. But so to me, that just means that Zuckerberg is trying to market share away from banks and financial processors. It doesn't really mean that he's competing with Bitcoin. Like, this is just something internal, something that already was happening, the whole fintech evolution of startups. They're trying to be and often succeeding in being more efficient and cheaper than banks. That to me is very different than a Jack Dorsey who's saying, this open source protocol, I love it. I just want to integrate with it as much as possible. I think that is a lot more bold, to be honest, than what Facebook is talking about. It's a bit unfair to say that Facebook is going into cryptocurrency is like, that is a bit weird to me, because it's like Amazon already has a dollar backed token. Like you can buy Amazon coins and they're just almost one to one trade for dollars. And then you can buy things on Amazon with that or gift it to people. Like it's kind of old wine in new bags, I think, which doesn't mean that it could become big like Apple Pay or something like that. But it's much more fintech than cryptocurrency.
For people who are listening to this and they're saying, hey, you know what? This interests me. I'm going to learn some more about it, whatnot. I think the number one thing that would be on that person's mind would be, how are you valuing Bitcoin today? Like, how are you coming up with a value for this currency that has never been done before? Talk us through how you think about that.
For several years, I did not understand when people asked me this, like investors, they're like, how do you value Bitcoin? I'm like, what do you mean? Like, obviously it has value because it could disrupt all these markets, but that's not what they mean. They mean relative to its current adoption, is the Bitcoin price overvalued or is it undervalued? Is it higher than it should be or lower? And then, yeah, we really invested a lot of time trying to come up with a good answer. To me, the way to value Bitcoin is, you first identify what its core use is, and then you try and measure that activity. You look at how the price evolves relative to that activity. And so to me, the core use case of Bitcoin is saving. It sounds a bit weird because it sounds so passive, but really, I mean, Bitcoiners call it hodling. Like you just hold your Bitcoin, and the idea is that it's a store of value. It's serving you every day by being liquid. You have that optionality of being able to sell it every day. The very, very cool thing about the Bitcoin blockchain is its transparency. Not that you can see all the identities of who's using it, but what you can see is the age of the transaction. So you can see how long people have been holding on to their coins or how briefly. And so it's a little bit like, imagine if you could, in the gold world, if you could identify very large amounts of gold after being immobile for, say, 100 years, if a very large amount of gold all of a sudden started moving, well, that should mean something. That's a significant event. And you can aggregate those things. And we have a measure that we call liveliness. You can see the extent to which Bitcoin is being meaningfully used as a savings settlement platform. So we have one measure derived from that that we call unrealized profit and losses. So that's basically the aggregate amount of unrealized gains or losses. We can track that over time. And so then we can start identifying the sentiment of the market. If there's, for example, in late 2017, we had huge unrealized profits. All these investors had basically paper profits. And then finally, as the market declined, we had a capitulation in November 2018, during which that unrealized profit turned into an unrealized loss. And that was really painful. And it was very palpable in the sentiment in the market. So that's one measure. And then the other one, of course, there's many others, but those are the two main ones that we lean on. What we call HODLer net position change. It answers the questions, are Bitcoin whales in the aggregate, are they accumulating more Bitcoin? Are they saving or are they dissaving and moving and selling their coins? Using that, we can identify periods of overvaluation and then also capitulation. And then right now, we believe we are in accumulation. We think this is the accumulation phase. It's the last phase of the bear market. Maybe you can link to this, but we put out a report that's called Bitcoin in Heavy Accumulation, where we make this case is that the bottom is likely in, and we're currently trading in a range between 3,000 and 6,500. And once we break out of that, that's going to be the start of the next bull market.
Very interesting. And we'll definitely link to a report, Bitcoin in Heavy Accumulation, in our show notes. For us, primarily looking at the stock market, it looks very, very volatile to look at Bitcoin. This recent 8% drop you saw from 2017 to the end of 2018, it's not as unprecedented as many people might think. If you do follow Bitcoin, this is more the rule than the exception. Ter, could you please walk us through the various bull and bear markets for Bitcoin?
So we actually have a drawdown analysis in our report as well, where we kind of put it all together in a table. I'm reading from it right now. The numbers are actually much higher than what you suggest. Measuring a bull cycle, you're starting from the bottom of the previous cycle, not from the previous top necessarily. So for example, I mean, the percentage gain of the first one is almost, it's almost incalculable. It's, based on what we saw, it was almost 1,000,000% just because Bitcoin hardly had a price early on. But then in the second bull market, which ended in late 2013, there the percentage gain was 51,000%. And then in the most recent bull market, which ended in late 2017, the total gain was 9,500% from the bottom. And it bottomed at about $150. So yeah, we went all the way up to close to 20,000. What's interesting about these drawdowns is that they become more shallow. And just like you heard, I mean, the percentage gains, even though they're obviously astronomical, they do lower over time. And we see the same thing with the drawdowns. They also become more shallow. And that, to me, is a sign of this maturation process, is that, yes, Bitcoin is cyclical. But if you think of it, all commodities have cycles. Oil has cycles, copper, gold. What I think is happening is that Bitcoin is slowly maturing into a full-fledged commodity with these very long cycles. And so the amount of days per cycle has increased in Bitcoin, and the downturns are becoming more shallow. So, for example, the first crash of Bitcoin in 2011 produced a downturn of 92%. Second bear market, we had a drawdown of 85%, and the most recent one was 84%, which, you know, is very close, of course, to the last one. I think this ICO mania, the mania of 2017, I think that pushed prices higher than they would have gone if it was just Bitcoin, kind of boring Bitcoin, quote unquote. And so I think the drawdown would have been less.
Very fascinating. Anything else that you think would be pertinent for a person who really doesn't know a lot about this field? And I guess I call it a field because it encompasses so many different aspects of currency to network effects to encryption. And I mean, you could just go on all the things that this movement kind of has going on. What do you think you would say to a person who's never looked into this before? What would you say to them?
I would suggest to buy an insignificant amount of Bitcoin. I'm not even talking about an investment. You just buy a very little bit. And what it tends to do is that it gets people, it becomes something on your radar, and you kind of follow it a bit more and you become more interested, just because it's a really interesting experience to actually have Bitcoin on your phone, for example. It's like this weird thing. Like, all of a sudden, I have something on my phone that I can send anywhere in the world to view to anyone without somebody in the middle, like without counterparties. It's a really powerful experience. So I think that would probably help people understand where some of this passion comes from. Because I think it's pretty clear that there's just lots of passion, you know, you could say zealotry even in the Bitcoin space.
What's the biggest risk an investor in Bitcoin faces today?
In my opinion, the biggest risk that an investor faces in the Bitcoin space today is counterparty risk. So it means that you store your Bitcoin with a custodian, with an exchange, and then they get hacked. And there is no FDIC insurance, there's no bailouts, it's gone. Like, that is the biggest risk. And that has scared people in the past, and it will continue to scare people. And it's just the flip side of the coin of Bitcoin, where you create a trustless system that has no central banks. And that also means that you have to take responsibility and think about how to store your coins.
If my mom was listening to this, she'd say, well, Turi, you just said that it can't be hacked. So go into the difference between the protocol getting hacked and an exchange, just so they kind of understand what you mean by third-party risk.
It's the analogy of gold banks in the 19th century and before. Like, you know, the fact that gold is a reliable store of value, it doesn't mean that you cannot lose your gold if your local bank gets robbed.
All right. So, Tur, I just want to give you the opportunity, because you pump out some just incredible content. Your writing, anytime you post an article, also your Twitter feed is just incredible. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about you?
I would say just Google my name. The first result is my Twitter page. And then I have a sticky tweet on top of that. I don't think you even need a Twitter account to see that. That links to our latest report. It's 15 pages. It's been read over 20,000 times around the world. And we can see where the downloads come from. So it's so fun to see these extremely remote places in Africa and beyond, like, people are reading it. And we really put a lot of effort into it. It's like several months. It's widely circulated in institutional circles as well.
We just love having you on the show. And the reason we love having you here is because you are so balanced in your perspective on how you see things in this space. And we just look forward to the next time that we invite you to come back and have another conversation. And if things go the way it's looking, it might be sooner rather than later, because I'm sure if the price continues to go up, there's going to be a lot of people interested in this to learn more. So thank you for your time today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much, guys.
All right, guys, that was all the press that I had for this week's episode of the Investors Podcast. We'll see each other again next week.
Thanks for listening to TIP. To access the show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. To get your questions played on the show, go to asktheinvestors.com and win a free subscription to any of our courses on TIP Academy. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making investment decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the TIP Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.